my success should not come at the expense of yours. My success should be connected to yours. And when you start thinking about success in the aggregate for the community, it's not that I'm not going to be successful. It's that I and you can share in that success, right? So that is a fundamental shift in how we think about doing business.
This is the Righteous Capitalist Podcast, hosted by Doug Zacher. How we make money matters.
Hey, I hope you all are doing well. I'm Doug Zacher, and thank you for listening to The Righteous Capitalist. This episode's Righteous Capitalist is Charles Rosen, who co-founded Ironbound Hard Cider. Based on his career experiences and expertise, Charles could be on podcasts about a wide range of topics. He could be on one about politics, because he's not only run political campaigns, but also took a stab at Congress himself. Having been trained as an attorney and working as a movie producer, he could easily talk about either of those subjects. And let's not leave out the years he spent running national ad campaigns for the likes of Mike's Hard Lemonade and Svedka Vodka. But these days, Charles spends his time thinking about how once nearly extinct apple varieties, a winemaker, and former convicts can assist in the rejuvenation of Newark, New Jersey's communities. That being said, I'm sitting here 52 miles from Newark on the farm in rural New Jersey where apples are grown, the cider is made, and at least one life has been changed. Charles and I have already figured out we can talk for a long time about how enlightened entrepreneurs can improve business. So I'm going to stop my intro right here and get right into it. Well, so welcome, Charles, or should I say, thank you for having me.
It's so much fun to have you here. And as you said in the introduction, I know it's hard to start these things because we keep going off on tangents. And I don't know if you have a podcast that runs for 20 straight hours, but it would be fun to...
Yeah, listeners should know. Right. Charles and I were talking for about a half hour before I even did the intro.
Right.
So this is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
We're sitting here in Ironbound's tap room, tasting room in Western New Jersey. We're 52 miles away from Newark. So could you just fill our listeners in on what you're up to here and how it is that this is going to impact Newark?
Yeah, I can start by saying we had no intention of being 52 miles from Newark. I think that's the important place to start. What had happened was about 7 years ago, I started a business in Newark focused on what I was considering, you know, workforce development and urban renewal. How could I come in and help participate in reigniting the Newark economy? I saw Newark as a place that was exemplary of how we think about community development, how we think about business in our country. At the time, less than 8% of the jobs in Newark were held by Newark residents. So I saw a need to go in and show that businesses could actually care about the people within the community and build in partnership with them, as opposed to taking advantage of, let's say, access to cheap land mm-hmm. or cheap labor, and then run back to Montclair, where I live, which is how most people do business in Newark. So we started looking at all different areas of urban agriculture, and we were engaged in research and development on controlled environment growing and community gardens and healing the shorelines on the Passaic River. And about 2 years into our work, we came to learn that the very first industry in Newark ever was hard cider. Legend has it that George Washington only drank Newark cider, and it was great. It was actually known as the Champagne of Ciders in the 1700s and 1800s, and in awesome Jersey fashion, they used to sell it on the black market as champagne, which I like. When I heard that, I love the idea that Jersey's been Jersey forever, right? Yeah. So,
and when I read it, I was like, here's a master marketer. Like you must have taken some tidbit of something and blown it up into this great story. But the more I read, I realized it was true.
That's incredible. So when we came to discover the history of Newark cider, I looked at a couple of things. First, we came to also learn that cider was the fastest growing segment of the alcohol category at the time, as well as the idea of building a company that had deep historical roots in the city that we were looking to serve mattered to me because place matters, right? Often we do business in total disregard of place, and place includes the people, the geography, everything about it. So knowing that there was this history and that there was this huge population in Newark who had come to Newark, especially this Southern Black migration that came to Newark to be part of what we would call the new economy in those days, we're still eager to work and still eager to participate in doing something that mattered. So as everything happens in New Jersey, it's very difficult to become any to do business in this state. And so we came to learn to be a cider in New Jersey, we had to have a winery license. To have a winery license, you need to be producing, fermenting at your site of fruit growing with a minimum acreage of 3 acres of fruit. So really hard to find, you know, the 5, 6, 10 acres we needed in Newark. And we didn't think many people would want to be drinking cider made from apples in Newark anyway. So we very begrudgingly found this farm about 50 minutes from Newark to be our site of our orchards as well as our main production area. And so I was really upset that we had to leave, you know, our home base in Newark to come out here. But in the end, it was the most important thing that happened to the company. First, it gave our Newark-based workforce the opportunity to get out of the city on a daily basis, right? So most of our Newark team are still in their gangs. We hire predominantly formerly incarcerated men and women. And our workforce has expanded to include immigrants and veterans.
How big is your workforce?
Well, it varies, you know, depending. Right now, we're probably at 40 plus people. Wow. And out of that, I'd say a good third are formerly incarcerated men and women, or what we like to call returning citizens.
Mm-hmm. And then how much of the total are from Newark?
Sort of half of our workforce are from, well, Newark and surrounding area, right? This idea of allowing these men and women to come to a space that's really nurturing and is about healing, both in terms of how we think about agriculture, but also in terms of community development. So that was a key element, but also this idea that we started to see what community that had both urban and rural sort of members coming together. The greatest divide we have in our country is urban versus rural, right? And we have a whole economy and we have a whole political system that is really just in service of the people in the middle, mm-hmm. right? So if you look at New Jersey as an example, so you've got this desperate impoverished inner core of, let's say, Newark, with a ring of tremendous wealth around it, right? Like where I live, right. Montclair, mm-hmm. and then there's Maplewood and Summit and mm-hmm. you know, Basking Ridge. And then you come out to another kind of ring of poverty, this agrarian poverty, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, our whole business model kind of boils down to this idea that, like, well, how do we connect those folks from that inner center with the people, the working poor, the chronically underemployed of that outer ring, and have the rich folks in the middle pay for the whole thing. Right? So it's
brilliant.
It's a great idea. Coincidental that we have a gluten-free, no sugar right. added, uh-huh. no preservative, right. you know, all fresh uh-huh. pressed apple cider. Right. That's really uh-huh. not for our Newark workers right. or the farmers out here, right? It's mm-hmm. for a lot of the soccer moms in the middle.
So, right. Give the people what they want.
Right. So pay a premium for how we do business. Business is a big part of what we do. So this idea of coming out here in terms of community building was incredibly important, but it also allowed us to extend our innovation and research on regenerative agriculture in a way that we simply couldn't be doing in the cities. Overall, the answer of, you know, how did we end uh-huh. up 52 miles outside of Newark right. was very unintentional, mm-hmm. but again, critical to the development of the company. Right. And then the last thing on that is what we continue to do, though, is as we innovate out here, we think about how do we bring those innovations back into the city. So mm-hmm. Part of our activity is our mushroom growing operation out here. We're working on a model that could be controlled environment, fully off the grid, growing of mushrooms in shipping containers. It on abandoned lots in Newark that uses wow. rainwater reclamation and has a, uh-huh. a companion crop to the mushrooms called spirulina, which will scrape the carbon out of the air.
So it sounds like you had to move out to the farm, but that was a great thing. It taught you so much more, which sort of implies getting into this, you didn't know a whole hell of a lot.
Yeah.
So let me ask this. So you're a Canadian lawyer who has produced movies and created national branding campaigns and political campaigns. Why this? Why now?
A lot of this came out of, instead of in a very typical liberal elite social justice warrior way, which is exactly how I went into Newark, right? Which is like, I think I know I can be the voice for the voiceless, right? I'm going to go and I'm going to help, you know, returning citizens mm-hmm. and all the black community in Newark, you know, I'm going to be their thing. That's bullshit. That doesn't work, right? There's a level of arrogance to that simply isn't warranted.
You're not the first to learn it either.
Well, but yeah, I hope others also share a level of humility that can allow them to.
Right. Hopefully not the last to learn it. Put it that way.
You look at anybody that's currently running for president, I don't know if they've all learned a level of necessary humility. But so, you know, how does, you know, lawyer turned movie producer turned ad guy turned politician become a farmer? It's that we started to see where the work needed to be, right? And I spent a lot of time, well, experimenting and mostly failing at coming to this understanding that there really isn't a distinction between working on human repair as well as repair of the land and the earth, right? They're very interconnected. And we as people are very interconnected. And so, you know, I was joking about being that typical social justice warrior guy going into Newark. Well, now I realize it's not about me coming off the hill in Montclair to help folks in Newark. It's that I am part of an interconnected community. So whether within that community you're an African-American, formerly incarcerated man, or you're coming back from a tour of duty in Iraq, or you're, you know, a lesbian Puerto Rican, you know, or a white Jew from Montclair, like, because I've got all of those here, you know, as each one of us becomes stronger emotionally, intellectually, financially, mm-hmm. the whole company and the whole community gets stronger. So I think this idea of how did we end up farming and how did we mm-hmm. end up making a cider, it was all sort of just following that path,
right?
So it was sort of, you know, exposed to us rather than us saying, mm-hmm. like, that's what we're going to go do.
Right. How did any of this, or did any of this ever manifest in your previous work? As an ad guy, as a movie producer. I mean, these are bold thoughts that you have.
I think all of it has and none of it has, right? So, but understanding, you know, first of all, how a brand resonates with mm-hmm. consumers, understanding how creating a closed economic loop that benefits everyone within that system, understanding that how businesses do business matters, mm-hmm. all of that came from my prior work.
Right.
And also...
Because you learned hard lessons there? Because you actually applied it?
I think, you know, one thing I learned, and especially in my work in the political arena, is that once you understand for whom the system works, you realize it's working beautifully, so there's no incentive for it to change. Mm-hmm. If I look at any sector, the food sector, the energy sector, the political sector, anything, once you understand who those systems are working for, you realize they're not going to change. So my goal in seeing all of that was to say, okay, well, instead of calling for systemic change, I'm going to do my best to try to build an alternative system, mm-hmm. right? Can I build another model that becomes a proof of concept for people to say, you can actually participate in this healing work. You can treat people with dignity. You can pay living wages. You can help repair the damage to the earth, and you can still make money.
Right.
Right. And so it was fun for me because all of my, you know, friends on the right are thrilled that I'm not talking about entitlements and handouts anymore. Mm-hmm. And my friends on the left are thrilled that I'm serving really the most underserved members of the community because that other system doesn't work for them.
So when you hire somebody, I assume you're paying a decent wage. I mean, to pay shitty wages after everything you've said would be pretty sinful at this point. So I assume you're paying them a good wage.
First, I think you're right. It would literally be criminal, I think, if we didn't pay living wages. We continue to evolve our compensation model, and we think all the time about different models of ownership, mm-hmm. right, and profit participation, and building little divisions within the company or are integrated companies that allow members of our community to now grow in another direction and have ownership of something, and where we're at, let's say, the community that we focus on in terms of repair.
Right.
Let's call it the chronically underemployed
right.
members of our community. So again, that includes primarily formerly incarcerated men and women, veterans, immigrants, people with special needs. So every one of these people, most of whom just got out of jail. Mm-hmm. Many are still living in halfway homes.
Right. And many of whom have never had what you or I would consider a regular job.
No.
Showing up on a daily basis, getting paid for that work.
Right. Jumping back for 1 second, because I think it's really important. When somebody comes out of prison, at least in our state, and state by state the rules are different, it's illegal for them to live in public housing. Right. So mm-hmm. I knew a young man, worked for us for a while. When he got out of prison, he was living with his mother in her Section 8 housing. The housing authority found out, she was kicked out and became homeless at 64 years old. Jeez. Right. It's illegal to work around open alcohol.
Right.
So most of our men and women can't be ticket takers at the Prudential Center because there's alcohol served.
Right.
They can't be waiters and waitresses in restaurants. They can be dishwashers.
Right.
It's fine to be back of the house, but you can't be a waiter or waitress.
So when they were building the Prudential Center, and I assume there was all this talk of all the
serving
jobs we're bringing to Newark, blah, blah, blah.
Well, again, this is why
there were all
I said,
sorts of people who couldn't work there.
Well, you have to, again, start with the notion that less than 8% of the jobs in Newark are held by Newark residents. Mm-hmm. If that's the starting point, I don't know where those 8% are, but I know the 92% are kind of out of luck. So number one, they can't live in affordable housing. They can't work around open alcohol. The day they get out of prison, all of their fines, court fees, child support payments, alimony payments, all start to, the clock starts again on all of those.
Uh-huh.
So you can't get a job and you can't live anywhere and you owe all of this money.
Jeez.
You have no choice but to go back to the streets.
Mm-hmm.
You have no choice. The only system that welcomes you back in is the gang system,
mm-hmm.
right? And the gangs are built in a very powerful way where they don't only represent opportunity for financial gain, but they're the only place of community, of brotherhood,
mm-hmm.
right? Of support, because you may have alienated your family, the whole time that you're in prison. So that's the starting point for mm-hmm. the majority of our workforce. So what we looked at was, how do we not only compensate people fairly so that they can deal with those struggles, but also continue to increase their different areas of revenue to take the place of something like the mm-hmm. amount of money that they can make as a dealer, right? Part of our model is also allowing for that transition to happen. This is very slow work. Transitionary work,
mm-hmm.
whether you're talking about human transformation
mm-hmm.
or healing the land or mm-hmm. growing a tree,
right.
It's slow work.
Right.
Right. So in our compensation model, we also have to take into account how slow that work is. You don't get fired if you don't show up 3 days in a row, right? My guys are late every day, mostly coming out here from Newark. You got three black guys in a car out here. You're getting stopped by the cops, right? We call it the third man rule.
Right.
And it really blows the cop's mind when two of them are Bloods and one's a Crip. They don't know what's happening. So most of my guys have to carry a little ID card that's got my cell number on it and their PO's number and explain what we're doing. Cause we're in Western Jersey and there are three black guys, in a car. So compensation.
Let's get to an answer.
So here's
the straight up question. Somebody who's chronically unemployed,
yep.
let's say they just came out of prison.
Yep.
I want quick answers for
yep.
this. How do they find you? Or how do you find them?
Okay.
We're working our way up to the compensation.
Because
I all of a sudden thought, it's not just about
compensation,
but really it's the whole lot of it, right? I mean, they have to get here first.
Yeah.
Quick answer. I want a quick answer.
So we work with different groups or agencies. Mm-hmm. We've done a lot of work with New Jersey Reentry Corporation. We work with a group called Community Opportunities, who work with people with special needs. We work with the Greater Newark Conservancy. So we've tried to work with a lot of not-for-profits mm-hmm. or public agencies that can funnel people to us. I know you want a quick answer, but every part of this has layers of complication
to
it. Most of those people coming through those programs aren't ready to work here.
Right.
But those programs are funded by moving people through their system.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Right.
So person after person after person that comes here has not had things like mental illness, addiction, or, you know, daily crises that you and I could never imagine addressed.
Right.
So it's taken me a long time, 7 years, to figure out that, like, having a record isn't the only requirement to work here, right? So it's been very hard, and most of our recruiting failed. And most of my guys are back in jail. We had a really bad start to this. So that's
so they find us
through agencies.
They find you through that,
and I get a lot of calls from guys in prison because, like, guys talk, right? So when one of my guys go back in and somebody's coming out, I get a lot of calls.
Even I know how good the prison grapevine is.
Right, you hear legit
all these stories about it. It's obviously legit.
Yeah.
All right,
so they find us.
So they get to you, and when they're here, what is the totality of what they earn when they're working with you?
Yeah, so we start at $15 an hour, plus I pay 100% of their health insurance. So that's employee-wide. We pay a certain amount of allotment of expenses for commuting, again, because of a lot of our guys are coming from Newark, so part of their compensation includes daily commuting, food, and other expenses on top of that. So I think at some point we figured out that their starting salary, all of that stuff combined, is something like $22 or $23 an hour. I forget exactly what it is. After a three-month sort of period, if they stay, it increases from there. So that's where we start. Most of these, or a lot of these people, unfortunately, have never, as you said, ever had a real job. Many of these men and women haven't graduated high school. And so it's a pretty robust place to start. And then, you know, compensation after that can include everything from profit participation in one of the areas that we're innovating, or, you know, other steps up if they become kind of managerial.
And there's also the training they get.
That
is going to benefit them whether they stay here or leave here.
That's right. So a lot of training. So we do a lot of what I was mentioning, soft skill training. So spent 2 years developing a curriculum with a professor from Columbia University, from the Earth Institute at Columbia. It's a 240-page training manual on these skills, again, like things like conflict resolution, family reorientation, fiscal literacy. In addition, we spent a lot of time, and this is helpful that I'm an attorney, getting people exempted to be able to work around alcohol. So if they don't stay here, they can go and maybe be a manager at a restaurant or work at the Prudential Center. So there's what I would call the soft skill training, but then also the hard training. The other thing is what we're really trying to build, instead of people coming for a bit and then leaving, we're trying to build this ever-expanding kind of community, this, again, this closed economic loop, right? So maybe you don't want to be a farmer, but that doesn't mean you don't want to necessarily participate in a restaurant that is utilizing the produce that one of our farming partners is growing, right? Or you want to have a food operation, or you want to have an entertainment company that needs a venue. All of these things are very, very interconnected. So our ultimate hope is that nobody leaves. They just kind of come into the community. And we joke, I know a lot of people, you know, over the 7 years, we've built a really close community of restaurateurs and food producers and other agricultural companies. And I joke that we're the farm team for those companies, right? I could never employ the amount of people that I want to employ. I just never could. But that doesn't mean that my friends and network can't. So if you spend a season or two here, and then I, you know, employer to employer, talk to one of my friends at a restaurant or at a bar or at a food producer and say, okay, Jane Smith, she's a rock star, you know, you need her. We end up being the farm team for those other organizations, because so many employers love the notion of being what's known as a second chance employer, but they simply do not have the capacity, the time to train those guys. So the idea of being a second chance employer is, you know, I think really sexy, and criminal justice reform and reentry is a really hot topic on both sides of the aisle, and has been for the last handful of years. But the reality is, if you're not a system designed to allow the time and energy to allow that transformation to happen, it ain't going to work.
The fact that other people can't do it, but you can, obviously means there's an expense to it. You are doing so much more than, say, Angry Orchard is. Mm. You're a business. I mean, where in this, this is all spectacular, no doubt. How do you end up making money doing it the way you're doing it?
We're proving that you have to do business this way, right?
Yes.
So it's almost the alternative.
Right.
It's not like, can you afford to do business this way? The real question is, can you afford not to do business this way?
I agree 100%.
Right? So when I look at really successful companies that are focused on environmental and social repair, mm-hmm. or companies that are building huge value in their offering because of how they do business, mm-hmm. those companies can charge a premium for their product.
Right.
Right? So if we chose to make Ironbound hard cider from concentrate from overseas, mm-hmm. you know, and have, you know, migrant labor working on the farm, I could make more money.
Right.
Right. Or in the short term, I would make more money, mm-hmm. but my brand stands for nothing.
Right.
And one thing I know in the alcohol industry, especially, and this happens in a lot of spaces, mostly what we drink is about what does it say about us, the consumer,
right?
Right? So if I'm at a bar and I want some person at the other side mm-hmm. of the bar to think that I'm cool enough that I can maybe build the courage to go talk mm-hmm. to them, you know, I got to order the right drink, right? Rarely has anything to do with the liquid.
Uh-huh.
Rarely, right? Some people are like, oh, this is too sweet, this, too that. Bullshit. It has to do with what does it say about me,
right?
The consumer, right? This drink is my badge.
Mm-hmm.
So when people know how Ironbound does business, they know our workforce program, they know our regenerative ag program, they know that we've built a network of local family farms that are now getting living wages, right? You know, I was always struggling with the value of millennials, right? Like, what do they do for us? And I realized the answer is, as consumers, millennials care desperately about how businesses do business. So if a Starbucks arrest two black guys mm-hmm. for using a bathroom in Philadelphia, they were like, nope.
Right.
And they shut that down fast, mm-hmm. right? And there's Howard Schultz
right.
shutting down the company
right.
for employee reorientation. That was a necessity because Starbucks has the capacity to charge, I don't know, five,
right.
six, seven times what Dunkin' mm-hmm. Donuts can charge for a same cup of coffee, but in a styrofoam cup.
Right. Right.
So
how much of a premium can you charge for cider?
You know, we're working that out because we didn't want to charge a premium at the outset, right? We're a young brand. We've only been in the market 2 years,
right.
Almost three. We needed to create value. So what we first needed to do, we made a decision to go head-to-head with the big six-pack guys, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Angry Orchard's made by Boston Brewing Company. Smith & Forge is Miller Coors. Crispin's owned by a large company called C&C. So we wanted to be in a six-pack going against the big six-pack guys. We didn't want to be, you know, thought of as a artisanal, hipster thing
right.
in a 750 craft cider in a 750 milliliter bottle corked as if we're some really bad version of wine. We're like the Jersey version of craft, right? We're a little broken. We're a little, but you know, it's still 100% fresh pressed apples. It's got all the right craft cues,
mm-hmm.
but we didn't want to, you know, create this
right.
elite thing. We think food should be affordable.
And good. I gotta
good.
Say,
I'm
not
real
a cider
food.
Guy. I had my first taste of cider in years, because I think I must have had some mainstream cider the first time I tasted cider years ago. Never picked up another bottle or can of cider. And I can honestly say your cider will be in my fridge forever now. I mean, really, it's that good.
And thank you for saying that. It's less about it being a premium as much as it is about us having the proper volume in our distribution, right? So a New Jersey bar simply shouldn't have any other cider on tap,
mm-hmm.
right? We are New Jersey's only cider. We are the only cider available in the state that's 100% fresh pressed apples and no concentrate and no preservatives,
mm-hmm.
right? That means no sulfites. We are the only one.
Right.
So the fact that any bar has anything else on tap
uh-huh.
means that A, they don't know that story, or B, that they don't know that their consumers want something.
Right.
You know, of that quality. So we're building that, and we're having great success in doing that. And so it takes time. And again, much like the transformative work that I was talking about on the human or environmental scale, it also takes time to build a brand the right way.
Right. So you're saying a business run in the right way that pays attention to all of its stakeholders can charge a premium because of their message.
Yeah.
Provided they get that message out, obviously.
And here's actually maybe the most important part of it. Those businesses don't end up being commoditized, right? So what we're seeing in craft beer is the commoditization of the category in beer, not in cider, but in beer, because it's such a saturated market. So brands that had, now the goal is, you know, get, you know, your beer on shelf at all costs, right? So drop the pricing, increase the volume,
right?
And it's a race to the bottom,
right?
That is not a way to build brand loyalty. It's not a way to keep your customers. Right. It's a way to sell on discount, right? So when we opened our ad agency with Ben & Jerry's, I spent a long time with Ben & Jerry's, and living through the Unilever acquisition of Ben & Jerry's is fascinating. There was a period where Unilever wanted to move Ben & Jerry's to a Breyer plant in Nevada. And I had to say to the, you know, global head of ice cream at Unilever, which is great that that's a title that exists. But I had to say, well, let's see, we only have three things on our label, Ben & Jerry's, Vermont's finest, all natural, right? You want to move us out of Vermont. We already kicked Ben & Jerry out, and you want us to chase the low carb craze with like no added sugar. Right. I said, you know, you're forgetting what value there is in the brand. Yes. Ben & Jerry's single-handedly, Ben Cohen single-handedly got RBGH growth hormones in milk out of milk production in this country by doing business in a certain way with the St. Albans Creamery Co-op, right? One man got growth hormones out of our milk in this country.
Right.
How they chose to do business mattered.
Right. Well, I'm sitting here with a guy who single-handedly, well, obviously with the help of a couple other people, but who single-handedly is bringing back, what, one or two near extinct varieties of apples?
Three or four, but
three
who's counting?
Three or four, right.
I mean, we're not sure about.
I mean,
it's
that is
debatable.
Amazing. That
right.
No, you have brought something back from extinction.
Yeah, but A, that matters, and when you understand, again, the history of our country and the history of cider in this country and how the role it played in colonial America, it does matter, but also it helps enrich the brand story, right? And that story, that narrative that allows people to sort of address the tensions that we're all feeling at a time life, that's how you build a successful consumer-based brand, right? Mm-hmm. So chasing, you know, volume or going on price discounting, right, is not how you build a brand. I think we have the president that we have in the United States because he exemplifies what the narrowest definition of success in our country looks like, right? Which is this winner-take-all, zero-sum game where it's a badge to screw people over on the way to the top, right? Because that's how you do business.
Right.
And our answer is no. There's a different definition of success. My success should not come at the expense of yours. My success should be connected to yours. And when you start thinking about success in the aggregate for the community, it's not that I'm not going to be successful. It's that I and you can share in that success, right? So that is a fundamental shift in how we think about doing business.
Right.
And you can't name a sector where I can't tell you how you could be doing that business in that way to the benefit of your bottom line,
right?
So I do feel many companies, first of all, that engage, and I know you have a deep understanding of this space, but many companies that engage in corporate social responsibility is just window dressing, right?
Sure.
It's just greenwashing because it hasn't changed how they're doing businesses. Or other businesses are clinging to an archaic model for like quarterly returns.
Right.
But the businesses that are moving in a new direction, which I heard this phrase and I loved it. I heard this idea of being part of the solutions economy.
Interesting.
Right? Mm-hmm. It's not like we're not for profits.
Right.
And it's not like we're just raping the land or the people, but we're part of the solutions economy. And whether those solutions are environmental or social or cultural, it doesn't matter. And the companies that are going to succeed and move forward in this new era are these solutions economy-based businesses. Mm-hmm. So I think what we're building is a proof of concept. We're not I hope to God we're not the anomaly. Like, I hope to God we're not the exception to the rule. I hope that our model is ripped off everywhere.
I'm going to interrupt myself and Charles right there so we can break up my conversation with him into two parts. He's so full of inspiration and actual practical know-how that I think we should take a moment to digest all this. Besides, we can only remember so much, so by breaking it up, my hope is everyone out there is going to remember a little bit more. And what's to remember? There was so much about branding, which isn't surprising, given Charles's background in marketing and advertising. And of course, brand is important. It's what everyone talks about, whether it's a corporate brand or a personal brand. But I've never heard a business person talk so passionately about place and then apply that to their business. And let's face it, when Charles is talking about place, he's talking about people and the people who reside in that place and the people that make up a community that is the essence of that place and a community that thrives in that place. And here's a guy who figured out he couldn't even be in the place he thought he'd be, which was Newark. Instead, Charles, his partner, and his urban crew ended up in a distinctly rural location where Charles came to realize even more that place matters, which makes me wonder how mega corporations can really benefit all stakeholders when they have no meaningful connection to the places where those stakeholders exist. It's connected to a larger question I've had about whether or not being big is inherently bad. In the second part of this episode, Charles talks about his incredibly smart plans for expanding in a way that maintains the commitment to place that he's already discussed so passionately. Here's a hint and a bit of a cliffhanger. It has nothing to do with hard cider. So now you want to know when part two hits, don't you? Well, if you haven't already subscribed, I urge you to subscribe on whatever platform you're using, or alternately, go to therighteouscapitalist.com and give us your email at the bottom of the page. The Righteous Capitalist has production support from Julie Burstein. The voice you hear that is neither me nor my guest is Deborah Goldstein. Our sound quality is brought to you by John Melillo. And our music was written by the one and only Ron Carney. Thank you for listening and for taking this journey with us.
This has been the Righteous Capitalist Podcast with Doug Zacher. To learn more, suggest a Righteous Capitalist for the show, or to subscribe, visit us at therighteouscapitalists.com or find us on all social media platforms with the handle Doug Zacher. The Righteous Capitalist Podcast, how we make money matters.
All right.